are listening to KBOO Portland.
Coming Monday, March 16th at 11 p.m., Gremlin Time presents a suspense double feature.
You're alone and unarmed in the green hell of a Caribbean jungle. You're being trailed by a mad hunter who believes that you, a human being, are the most dangerous game.
Paul Frees and Hans Connery star in this adaptation of The Most Dangerous Game. Also, The Mask of Demetrios, starring Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre.
Let's put down a date. Istanbul, Turkey, 1938.
Monday, March 16th, 11 p.m., Gremlin Time.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from McMenamins, presenting Heated Rivalry, a jockstar rave with DJs Gregory Dillon and Michael Modrano at the Crystal Ballroom on Friday, April 3rd. Tickets and info at crystalballroompdx.com.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Good evening, you're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we're talking with Ethan Feider and with Mickey Gillette about their new play, about Mickey Gillette's new play, Riot Queens. Mickey, Ethan, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. Yeah. It's great to be here.
Oh, great. It's so great to have you all on. So tell me, Mickey, first of all, tell me, actually, let's go all the way back. Let's start by having you both introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourselves. We'll start with you, Mickey.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Emma. My name's Mickey Gillette. I'm a trans woman. I work at Basic Rights Oregon, and I'm also a playwright. And I'm here to talk about Riot Queens, our new play about the Compton's cafeteria riots of 1966.
Woohoo, and Ethan.
Such a good intro right there. I'm Ethan Feider. I'm also a trans person, a gender fluid person thing. And I'm an actor. I've been acting out here in Portland for about 4 years now. And I play Haley in Riot Queens.
Great. All right. Well, so you've got a new play, Mickey. We've had you on the show a couple times before, and this is really exciting to have a new play come out. I mean, you're one of Portland's most well-known and respected playwrights, and it's really exciting to hear about a new production. So, first of all, just let's get the details out right away so people know what's happening and when is the play happening and where. Tell us all the details.
Sure. So this play is being produced by Fuse Theater Ensemble. It will run from March 5th through March 29th, and it's at the Backdoor Theater at 4319 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. We have shows Thursday through Sunday. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday are evening shows at 7:30, and Sunday's a matinee.
Great. And Fuse, is that pay what you can, or how do they do that?
Yeah, exactly. So price is not a barrier for anyone. We want everyone who'd like to come see it to see it, and so all the tickets are pay what you will.
Oh, great. But I assume there's a basic like ticket price that is sort of the price that actually supports you as an artist.
Yeah. I think the suggested price is around $20. And some people pay more because they want to help other people who might have trouble making the $20 ticket.
Great, great. Ethan, is this your first performance with Mickey directing?
Oh, no. We've done quite a few productions now, the first being Blonde on a Bum Trip, which I was an understudy for. I did get to perform, though, which was very nice, but we've done quite a few shows together, so it's always really a huge honor and a privilege every time we do a show together, because it's truly the kind of work that I want to be doing as an actor.
Oh, great. Now, Riot Queens, that's a story about something that happened in California in the 60s. Tell me about it. What happened?
Right. In the Tenderloin district of San Francisco, there were a few blocks where trans people were allowed to live. And if they went outside of that area, they'd be arrested by the police. And living there itself wasn't that easy. They were often raided by the police, abused, harassed by the police. And this riot was an anti-police uprising, kind of like Stonewall, but it happened 3 years before. And it wasn't really that well known until a few years ago when Dr. Susan Stryker, who's a trans academic, did a lot of research and helped kind of unearth that it happened.
And what inspired you to do a play about this uprising?
I visited San Francisco a few years ago, and I had heard that there was a plaque for the Compton's Cafeteria riot. The cafeteria is not there anymore. And I went by and I saw it, and I found on my trip every day I kept going back and looking at it and, you know, kind of wondering like, oh, did what they do at that time, you know, did that change my life somehow? It felt a little mystical in a way. And when I came back to Portland, I started researching and trying to see if there was enough to really use as material for a play. And after I watched the documentary that Susan Stryker did called Screaming Queens, and then I wrote to the GLBT archives in San Francisco, and they had all of her oral histories. I got all of those. I read a book about Glide Memorial Church, where the first queer street youth activism took place in America. And from that, I was able to kind of have enough history to really make a drama out of.
Wow, that's great. Ethan, did you know about the history of the Compton Cafeteria riot before you began this play?
I did not, and it was very surprising, because, of course, I've heard of Stonewall, and, you know, it was crazy to learn that something so significant existed, and that, like, no one, I mean, I'm sure there are people in the community who know about it, but, I mean, none of the people I've talked to have heard about it before, and it is so significant to our history. And I'm really glad that Mickey had wrote the show, because it's something that I think we all should know about.
So Mickey, just to get a sense of kind of what the theatrical space is like, let's go to the actual space and talk about what that was like first. What was it like for trans women in 1965, was this when this happened, in the Tenderloin? I mean, this was just a cafeteria they went to, so why is that significant?
Yeah, it was a 24-hour cafeteria, so if a lot of the trans women who were living there were doing sex work at the time, because they weren't able to get hired anywhere else, and so they could drop in there before they did sex work, after. It was kind of a gathering place for everyone. But it was also a place where police would do raids and arrest people for impersonating a woman. And trans women weren't really accepted as themselves. Like, they couldn't use the women's restroom. There were issues. And it was also a time when a lot of things were changing. Gay people were starting to be accepted more in San Francisco. And that meant that people weren't necessarily putting up with the treatment that they had always had. There was the head minister at Glide Memorial Church had come from the South and had been a civil rights activist. And when he came to San Francisco, he's like, well, the group that needs help here are gay street youth. So he started using a lot of the same techniques that were used in the civil rights movement in the South to kind of raise the consciousness of people and give them techniques for organizing and protesting. All of these things were converging. Also, the hippie movement at the time. So, like, gender norms were changing because of the way young people were acting. All of this stuff was kind of swirling around, and I think led to this moment of combustion and change that happened in the riots.
So the cafeteria was a gathering place. Was it also a place of community building?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some people were really into that, and some people were like, why are you causing trouble? Which we dramatize in the play. Just like any moment of social change, there are some people who are on the vanguard, you might say. There's some people who are like, well, yeah, I would like the benefits of this, but I don't necessarily want to put myself on the line. And there's some people who are sort of entrenched in the way things have been. And I hope the play dramatizes all of those points of view.
So did it, I mean, as a gathering place, did it serve the same function that gay bars did at the time?
Yeah, I think it did. There is a queer bar that's dramatized in the play that was around called Chuckers. And that was a place where a lot of women met sex work clients. And this was more of kind of an off-duty, like, kick up your feet type of place. Also, people who weren't from that neighborhood and weren't from the queer scene would come just to kind of watch and be like, oh, wow, you know, this is, you know, maybe disrespectful or maybe just curious. So it was, yeah, it was kind of a social place that wasn't as work-oriented as Chuckers, the queer bar, was.
So, Ethan, as somebody who's playing a role in this performance, how do you connect with those trans women from, you know, more than half a century ago?
I mean, being trans is still something that is, there's people who oppose in some way and are angry at our very existence. So I don't think it's super difficult to find that kind of, especially today, that sense of opposition in the world and that kind of fear that is prevalent today. But in terms of connecting to, you know, historical folks, I think just diving into the era and like learning the history, something that really helps me a lot is music. I think it bridges a lot between the character and the actor. So I love to listen to the music of the era. Mickey has made us a wonderful playlist that I like to listen to and kind of get in that headspace. But I think really it's looking at today and how I feel about the things going on today also feels like it helps in many ways.
Let's jump to that for just a minute, and then we'll come back to talking more about the history. Mickey, how does this moment, how do you connect with the moment that we're in now as a playwright? In this performance, or just in your art?
Yeah, it comes up. I'm working on a new play now called In the Fascist Bathroom. it is scary to think. Like, I first started writing plays around 2011 and 2012, and it was like, oh, if we could only get people to understand. And then we went through this moment of visibility where it felt like there was all this positive change happening, kind of like in this play. And now, you know, just seeing that be challenged and rolled back is scary. I think it kind of brings out the need to fight, the need to protect each other. It doesn't feel like we have vocal allies the way we did a while ago, and it feels like we're really relying on our own resilience, which I think is something we see in this play also. You know, these are characters who really only have each other and are fighting to protect this little piece of life they have and maybe expand it beyond that. Right now it does feel like a fight, and it feels like I don't know, something that I say to myself that kind of gives me hope is that our need and will to be ourselves will always outstrip the hatred of people who oppose us. And there's sometimes when it's like, I hope that's true, but I think I do believe that in my core.
Thank you. So going back to the play again, going back to the historical space of the play for a minute, what was life like for a transgender woman, or were there trans men who hung out at, or gender fluid people who hung out at Compton's too? Or was it mostly just trans women?
Yeah, it was trans women and also young gay men, like hustlers, okay. is what they were, how they referred to themselves.
Uh-huh. So what was life like for one of these people, one of these women, or one of the men at this time? Like, I mean, can you paint a picture of maybe not a typical person, but maybe like at least one kind of person who, you mentioned a couple of things earlier that really... I noticed one was you talked about how it was illegal for trans women to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that most of them were sex workers.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And it was interesting in the oral histories, there really wasn't a sense of stigma around doing sex work. It was almost like pride, like I'm here and I'm making this work and I'm making money. And there was one woman in the oral histories who was like, I wasn't good at sex work, so she got a job at Chuckers as a waitress, and it was almost like people were glad that she was making it work for herself, but it was almost like, well, she can't even do sex work and she's not making very much money. That was sort of interesting to see. You know, they couldn't dress the way they wanted. They had to wear, like, it seemed like the border of what they could wear was like capri pants and an angora sweater. But so they couldn't wear dresses or skirts. If they weren't wearing an item of male clothing, they would be arrested for impersonating a woman. They couldn't rent apartments. There was a hotel where most of them stayed that was kind of a night by night place called the El Rosa. And yeah, there really was this border of just a few blocks where they could exist as themselves. Most of the women talked about having been picked up by the police and then publicly strip searched and having their heads shaved. So there really was this level of danger and brutality for the women all the time. And then that kind of changed. Another big change that happened was the war on poverty was beginning around this time. And the Tenderloin was identified as a poverty zone. So there was money that was coming in and people could get job training. The government was hiring a lot of people. So in these oral histories, it was amazing. You could hear someone like, I moved there, I was doing sex work. Then 2 years later, it was like Medicaid paid for my surgery and I had that government job because I did the training. And you're like, oh wow, the government could actually like help us and make our lives better as opposed to demonizing us. And,
wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Wow, so Medicaid was paying for surgeries back in the 1960s or 1970s for some.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really nice to hear.
Yeah, Harry Benjamin, who's kind of, if people know about trans medical history, is kind of a divisive figure, but he did open an office in Stanford, and a lot of women were seeing him to get hormones and then surgeries.
Wow, that's really exciting. You know. Yeah. So, Ethan, what did you learn in doing research for this role?
I mean, a lot of this is the stuff that I did not know beforehand. And, you know, I didn't understand really, like, how much they truly faced in that time. Like, I think learning about how the police treated them was something that really affected me. And I think also kind of learning the different perspectives was something that was really interesting. I feel like today we have a lot of solidarity as a community, and back then there was like kind of a little bit more separation, I feel like, for them. So also kind of learning like the terminology and the lingos was very interesting. The term queen is how they trans women would refer to themselves back then. And we had a discussion about how, like, in my mind, my modern perspective, queen is like, you know, a drag artist. So kind of understanding how they had different perspectives and how they, how that has like evolved over time was really interesting for me.
Mickey, do you think that there was a distinct trans female identity that was either existent or was something that evolved in the milieu of the time?
Yeah, I think so. I think from my understanding, a trans person at that time would have referred to herself as gay. Like, it was just the gay community, and there were different ways that that manifested. I think, yeah, that's it. It's so interesting because I'm someone who lived closeted until I was 38, and so to read about these women who in 1962 were like, I know this about me so deeply, and I can't live without expressing it and going to this place, probably on a hunch, because you wouldn't have been able to learn very much about it except just from people who might have visited, and going there and starting their lives, like, that's kind of amazing. Like, you know, really people who were sort of brave and almost like pioneering something new. So I think there was this pride that a lot of them had about being able to live their lives. And then the part that's documented, because maybe this was going on for decades before, I don't really know. It was a time of change where maybe someone would have gone there and been like, well, I can be a queen because I know that's who I am. But then all these new options open up, like, oh, I can get medical care. Oh, I could get these. There was something called the Office of Special Problems that opened where you could go there and get a card that said, even though my driver's license has an M on it, like, the government says I should be able to show up to work as a woman. And then you would show that to someone, and that's how you'd get hired for a job. And like, all of these new opportunities open that don't sound awesome to us now, but I think those allowed people to maybe expand their own mind. Like, oh, I don't have to necessarily see myself as a queen where there's only one job and one life and two blocks where I can live. Like, I can see myself as a woman, and there are these like places and tools that are helping me to do that.
What about trans men? What were trans men doing at this time? Do you know?
I really don't know. It wasn't something that came up in any of the research that I read.
I'll have to do some asking around, and maybe we could do a show about that.
I could
invite you on if you wanted to comment.
But yeah.
That would be, I would really be interested in getting, if there's any survivors left from that time. I mean, not survivors, but if there's anyone still living from that time, that would be really interesting to do a show. We did a show last winter with the producer of The Word Is Out, which was a film produced in 1979. And it aired first on PBS and also in theaters. And it was a documentary that interviewed 26 gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people from a cross-culture spectrum of roles in society across the United States. And it was really good. I mean, there were some people who were really well-known at the time, like Harry Hayes. Mm. Is that the name? Harry Hayes from the Radical Fairies.
Oh, yeah.
I love that name.
Yeah. And some other people who are pretty notable, but a lot of it was just ordinary people. And there were trans women in it, there were trans men, there were bisexual folks, there were people of color. I mean, it was a really great piece for its time. I mean, it was very forward thinking. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be able to interview the producer, one of the writers who did. Part of what was so interesting about it, and this may have been something that was interesting when you were doing your research about Compton, about the Compton Cafeteria riots, was that the way that they were thinking about how to produce their piece was so different. I mean, they were really being informed by the cultural milieu of the time, and so they were very like anti-authoritarian, they were very egalitarian. They had really deep kind of feminist ideas that went into how they did their production. Like, everything had to be like workshop first collectively. There wasn't any like, I mean, there was a person who sort of held the bottom line of the piece, but basically everything else was like co-worked, you know. I mean, things that we're really familiar with here in Portland. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were kind of exploring how to do filmmaking that way. I wonder, did any of, I mean, part of what you're talking about here with Compton Cafeteria Riots is that part of it was about where it was. I mean, there was this kind of evolving consciousness, this sort of sense of all these new sort of possibilities, and this was maybe part of an expression of that.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think, you could ask yourself, why do we know so much more about Stonewall than we do about Compton's? And I think some of it is that the people who were involved in Stonewall, well, Stonewall was in the Greenwich Village. The Tenderloin was kind of the red light district of the time. So like everybody went to the Greenwich Village to bars. So there were people who were already living like kind of middle class cis lives who were able to start doing political organizing in a way that most of the trans women couldn't. But another thesis that I think Susan Stryker put forth is Compton's was just really successful. Like all of these rules that everybody was mad at kind of went away immediately because the city was already wanting to do that. And like the raids stopped, people stopped being arrested for impersonating women. Trans women could try on clothes in stores in a way that they couldn't before. Like a lot of the demands that they had were just kind of immediately capitulated to. So I think, a lot of it was, a lot of the reason that the activism stopped is because the society was ready to accept people there.
So let's talk about the play again. First of all, if you can remind people where the play is and when it is, and any of that information you'd like to share.
Sure. Riot Queens is being produced by Fuse Theater Ensemble. The run of the show is from March 5th through the 29th at the Backdoor Theater, 4319 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. Tickets are pay what you will. We have evening shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30, and then matinees on Sunday.
So, Kyle, what's it like being in one of these productions? I mean, can you tell me a little bit about the process? Like, do you just show up and, everybody's already knows what to do, or how does that work?
It's usually, it's a pretty standard process, I feel like. We usually just get together and we do table reads at first, so that's kind of where we sit, at a table, and we just discuss kind of each scene by scene, and we kind of go more in depth with the context of it and the motivations behind every line, and we go line to line. And then from there, we usually do get on our feet, and we do blocking and stuff like that, and we understand where the scene goes physically for all of us. And that's usually the process there, but I think for shows like this especially, that table work is the most important because it is about the depth of these characters and the drama that their lives are, that they experience. It all comes together and totally when the audience is there. I think personally for me, I never truly realize a character until I'm standing in front of an audience and I see, like, I feel their energy, mm-hmm. I think it's always a really intense process, especially for material like this, but it's very gratifying to be able to deliver that to an audience.
How do you, Mickey, how do you really sensitively and respectfully portray the fact that a lot of these people were sex workers? I mean, is that something that you think about in terms of how you portray the piece? Is there any conversation around that?
Oh, well, let's see. So the first draft was really different than the current draft. Like, you saw a lot more of the outside world. So you saw one of the characters go on a sex work day. You saw them get picked up at Chuckers. You met Dr. Harry Benjamin. And then I worked on this with Luann Schuler from Artists Rep Theater. And we had these discussions, how big do we want this world to be? And as it went on, it became much more about these three main characters, three women that are depicted, Nina, Haley, who Ethan plays, and Dixie. And sex work it's just kind of a fact of their lives. It's definitely not stigmatized, although there are discussions about how it can be unsafe, and some women die in the Tenderloin. It's not an easy place. And there is a character who's asexual, who, you know, doesn't want to do sex work and can kind of see a world beyond this before everybody else can, really. Like, you know, what if this didn't have to be our lives? But it's not. I remember there was one oral history where this woman was like, yeah, I got one of those government jobs, but I still did sex work because the government job didn't pay very well and I wanted money. And so it was clear to me that there was no shame or stigma that these women held about it. And I think that's portrayed in the play.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Sure.
What about, so Mickey, you wrote the play?
Yeah.
So do you also direct it or somebody else do that?
No, Harper York is directing the play. She's a trans woman. She was in The Queers, the first play of mine that was produced. She lives in Pittsburgh, but came out here to direct the show.
And how long is the whole process from, not the part where you write the play, but once you've got a final product written, something that you're ready to say, I'm ready to do this.
Yeah.
Then how long is the whole process from there? Like casting.
Oh yeah.
The thing you were talking about, Haley. Ethan, sorry.
You
play Haley, right?
Yes. I'll answer to Haley.
And you know, all the way up until the first show. How long is that process, and what is that like?
Right. Well, casting can take place pretty early on because you want to make sure people are available and get them kind of committed to the show. It wasn't super early this time, though. Like, I think we did that in December or January or something.
Somewhere around then.
Yeah. And then, were you saying the rehearsal period's pretty short for this one?
I do gotta say, this is probably one of the shortest rehearsal periods I've ever seen, but it adds the pressure a little bit, and I like that.
Oh, okay.
It works, so.
Yeah, like, I'm kind of wondering when we're getting up on our feet, but I'm a little like, oh, we open in 3 weeks.
We gotta do that table work.
Yeah. So it depends on the director. The director usually sets the schedule. And directors usually really like rehearsing, so it can be like 5 weeks, but I feel like it's closer to 3 weeks this time, three or four weeks.
So rehearsals maybe 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
5 weeks sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the last week is, I don't know how anybody can do it, because it's like costumes, lights, sound, suddenly not having the scripts, like all of that happens at once and everything has to get synthesized to get rid. It's called Tech Week, and I'm just glad that I don't really have a job during that time, because it seems really stressful to me. How do you feel about Tech Week?
Well, in some circles they call it Hell Week.
Yeah.
And that is certainly the case, but like I said, personally I work better in high pressure environments, so I really like that time, because that's when I'm like, I feel most in tune with everything. And I make discoveries that I wouldn't normally make when I'm like relaxed and feel like I have time.
Oh, got it. Yeah, that makes sense. So do a lot of you know, I mean, it sounds like you know some of the people because you've all worked together. Does that make it a little bit easier with each new play you produce?
Yeah, I think it does. Like some people, like Ethan, and I've seen Ethan work before, and that's really comforting. And then there's new people, and it's always fun to meet new people. We have a stage manager, Kalila, who we've worked with before, who's just really delightful person. And, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I know what I'm getting with Kalila because they're great. And but then it is fun to see, like, the new energy. Like, this time, the other two main characters are being played by Bryn and Nineveh, who are new, and it's fun to see how they approach the work, and like that mix of new and old energies is kind of exciting.
How does it feel for you, Mickey, as the playwright, having to step, do you have to step back and just let the director do their job?
Yeah.
Do you just not even go see it? Or
No, I'm there, and this is my first time working with Harper as a director, and Harper's really collaborative, which is nice, but yeah, mostly I try just, If I think there's something that's helpful that I can share, I'll share. But for the most part, I listen. Sometimes I'll be like, oh, I want to change this line. Or Harper might be like, can I request a change? And so that, and that way it can be good to be there so that the script can be this living thing that we're working with. But yeah, that I feel like there needs to be a leader in the room, and it's the director, and no one should be looking for me for answers.
I mean, if your work lives on, then over the course of many years, it will be done in many different kinds of ways.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I would hope that this is a play that might resonate with people and that people might want to do because it's about like a history that's not super well known, but that's really relevant.
So looking at the future, how would you like your work to be seen by someone a generation or two from now? I mean, you're looking back at the Compton cafeteria riots and creating, you know, that fourth wall, you're creating a new space, a theatrical space for it. How do you imagine that people two or three generations from now will see what you're doing? I mean, do you think that... can you imagine that?
I mean, yeah, it's something I think writers always hope that people will still be curious about and interested in their work, you know, after they're gone. And I was an English major, so I read people's plays when I was in college. And there's this part of me that's like, oh, you know, maybe someone would want to do that with mine. I feel like the fact that I'm trans and I'm writing about trans subject matter would, you know, maybe make it interesting to people who are part of our community in a few generations. I hope that, you know, there's something kind of literary and timeless in the work that would make it something that people would want to return to. You can never really guess that, but that's, I try to put that in there.
This is a question for either of you. Do you think that in two or three generations, like, we'll still be dealing with the same themes? I mean, well, how do you think that we'll be seen?
Yeah,
the way that we're seen. I mean, we have the gift of hindsight to look back at our transcestors and say, oh, this is where we came from. This is part of where we came from. I mean, how do you think that we'll be seen by our trans heirs?
Yeah.
I mean, truly the optimist in me says that I hope that we do find a state of equality, but the historian in me knows that the differences in people has always been a tool of control for people, and otherizing people has always been something that those in power do. And it's kind of sad to say that I think that will always happen in some ways, and I hope it's not us, but also I hope it's no one else. So it's hard to truly say. I mean, but until then, I will keep fighting until we all find equality. And that's the future I want to see, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I know parents of trans kids who, you know, they started affirming their kids when they were like 4 years old, and the life that they see in their minds, like, I can't really conceive of always having been the person that you knew yourself to be. And there's going to be a lot of people growing up who see gender as like something personal and private, not something that, even though our government wants to say that they tell us who we are, like, I feel like there's a generation now that doesn't believe that. And that idea is so challenged though right now. Like, so it's hard to tell where it's going to end up. Like, it's my hope that people will look at what's dramatized in this play and be like, what was going on? How did the government think they could just treat people this way? But then we look at the way ICE is treating people right now, and it's no different. So we're just living in this really kind of barbaric time. And I want to believe, like Ethan does, that this is something we're going to move past and get to somewhere better. But I don't know. We're just in kind of a scary moment right now.
Do you think that we're going through a kind of cultural moment here in Portland where we live that's been kind of a renaissance for the trans community? I mean, I think that some people really feel like Portland and maybe Seattle, New York, Chicago, you know, a few major cities, but especially Portland have been places where there's been a real flourishing of transgender people in the creative arts and in all different kinds of ways of really being able to affirm who we are as people. Do you think that's happening right now?
Yeah, I do. I know the artistic director of Fuse Theater, Rusty Tennant, always says, no one in the country is doing what we're doing around trans representation. And it's really true. Like, I look around and I submit my plays to different places, and there aren't shows like this really happening regularly anywhere else. And yeah, I feel like Portland's maybe like 10 years ahead of where most of the country is, which is exciting. Like, it's exciting to live in a place like that. And when I visit other cities, they don't feel like Portland in terms of queer visibility and just this comfort in expressing one's gender however you feel.
What about theater more broadly? How is Portland as a theater town? Is Portland, you know, I mean, I go to, I'm from Minneapolis, and oh, like, Minneapolis is a real theater town. It's very independent theater, and we do the Fringe Festival every year, which is really fun. It's changed a lot. How does Portland compare with other theater towns that way?
Portland, like, Minneapolis has a lot of funding for the arts in a way that Portland doesn't. Oh, excuse me. So I feel like Portland is pretty scrappy. There's a lot of people who just really love theater and want to make theater and kind of find a way to do it, but there's not as much infrastructure here as there might be in other cities like Chicago or Minneapolis. I feel like there's great talent here, though. Like, I never go to a show and think like, oh, that actor wasn't very good or that set wasn't very good. Like, it's always pretty top tier. I think Portland just has a lot of great artists.
So Portland is very similar. It just doesn't have the same kind of funding for the arts that some maybe larger cities have.
Yeah, I think there's a few private benefactors like Ronnie LaCrute, Ellen Bai, who really help. And then, you know, if you want to make theater, you're like enlisting your friends to help you make theater. So I think there's like people who will it into existence, but yeah, there's not the same support publicly.
But it has a pretty vigorous theater scene anyways.
I think so, yeah. I think there's always shows you can see every weekend around here.
Yeah, that's exciting. What do you think about the theater scene in Portland?
Yeah, I actually was thinking a lot about this. I feel like the scene out here is very unafraid to present sort of the cutting edge of what is in the culture. I'm actually not from around here. I live in kind of a small town, and I see a lot of just very traditional, I'm doing air quotes here, safe theater. And, you know, the stuff that people are just have always seen and has been around forever. And when I come out here, I see that people are doing, you know, modern shows, you know, and they're doing stuff that anything you would like that has the representation of the community that normal shows just don't have. And I mean, I almost feel like the characters coming to in the show, coming to the Tenderloin, that's like this safe haven, this like beautiful, prospering community that has is unafraid to represent the truth of our society. And that's truly a beautiful thing.
You went to the Tenderloin a few years ago, Mickey. What's it like now?
One thing that's funny, I had this guidebook because I had lived in the Bay Area a while ago, but I was like, well, I've never really just explored San Francisco. So I took this guidebook and it had this map, and the map didn't list the Tenderloin as a neighborhood. It was kind of like, don't go there. It's called the Transgender Historical District right now. So there are like signs about that, and the poles have trans flag colors, which was kind of neat. When I was there, there were a lot of whatever the local version of the street response was, just people on the street kind of helping people. I think the news had made me think it was going to be much more extreme than it was. It really wasn't. No one knew anything about the Compton's cafeteria. And I asked people to help me with the plaque, including the street response people, and they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I had to use like Google image search to help me find it. It felt a little like Old Town, which is the neighborhood where the office I work is in, but maybe a little cleaner than that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much investment has been put into the Trans Historical District since San Francisco designated it. I mean, it was a big deal to get that historical designation. And I know that there's some social service agencies in the district that specifically cater to the trans community. I mean, I think that it still has a pretty significant trans population that lives directly in the Tenderloin. It's still a neighborhood that's historically known as a refuge for immigrants, for houseless people, for all kinds of sex workers. It's still kind of a haven for that. It's still a place where you can find one of the things that happened in San Francisco around that time that you wrote the play was that at that time there were a lot more SROs in the whole district, but the Tenderloin especially was a neighborhood where SROs were really abundant, a single residency occupancy. And so it was a place where you could easily find housing, sort of like the hotel that you talked about, where they were living in. And so it was traditionally a place where people who were really marginalized, who couldn't, one night they might be sleeping in an SRO if they don't have enough money, the next night they might be out on the street. Mm-hmm. And there's still a little bit of that history, that legacy in the Tenderloin, but not so much because the entire, just like all of San Francisco, the whole city has just been scrubbed by like big money and corporate investments and gentrification. And so the kind of really affordable housing and vibrant community standards that used to make the Tenderloin like this incredibly vibrant place, a really rough place too, just don't exist anymore because San Francisco as a whole has just been rendered almost completely unaffordable for the poorest people. I mean, the poorest people still have to live somewhere and they still find some place to live, but it used to be much easier to be poor in a city like San Francisco than it is now.
Yeah. When I was in college, I had friends from San Francisco and I went and visited them, and it was like a vibrant place. We would go see punk shows. There were like young people. And now, in my experience, it's just like young people in athleisure walking their dogs when they're taking a break from their tech job. And it just feels so boring and kind of antiseptic.
Yeah. So we've got just a few minutes left. So we're talking with Mickey Gillette and Ethan Feeder about the play Riot Queens. So, Mickey, tell us again about the details of the play.
Sure. Riot Queens is being produced by Fuse Theater Ensemble. The show will run from March 5th through the 29th at the Backdoor Theater, 4319 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. We'll have shows Thursday through Sunday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. The shows are at 7:30, and then we have matinees on Sunday. Tickets are pay what you will, so price is not a barrier for anyone.
So, Ethan, in the last few minutes, tell me a little bit about the role that you're playing, because I haven't had a chance to ask you about that yet.
Totally. I don't want to say too much, because I want to leave some room for some surprises. But Haley is probably, I want to say, kind of the elder of the three, the trio in the show. She's been there a little bit longer. She's seen a lot of what goes down there, and she's become very cautious of herself and her community. She has seen and experienced a lot, and that has made her quite guarded and defensive about, you know, what they have there. And I think for her, that is probably the most important thing, is ensuring that the people in her community know that it's not necessarily safe, but what they do have is something that is good and is growing. And she resists some of the changes happening. And that, I think, is the main kind of arc of her experience in the show, is kind of discovering that these changes are good and that more can be done. But yeah, I don't want to say too much, though.
Wow, it sounds like you know your character really well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, that's so exciting. What were some of the changes that people were experiencing at that time, Nikki? I mean, what was... You've referenced some of it, but what was changing?
So I think a lot of it... Well, there were two things. I think the political changes that were allowing people to imagine life outside the Tenderloin for themselves for the first time. And then the war on poverty money, just all these new opportunities around education and work and medical care that hadn't existed before. Before it was like, you know, we just need to huddle in this place. And then suddenly it was like the world was offering people new options. And, you know, like Ethan said, Haley didn't know if that was something that could be trusted, didn't know if... You know, this change could be for the worse, not for the better, but other characters don't feel that way. And I guess one thing I do want to make sure I say is the whole time Luann and I were working on this, my guiding light was this show needs to be so dramatic and interesting that even if it wasn't about this historical moment, it would still be worth watching. So I hope people know this isn't like a school textbook. It's a drama. There's like juicy love triangle. There's a lot that goes on in it.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's like the three main women. So it's Sapphic. And there's Haley and Dixie are two characters who have a past. They have dated, but Haley has some really hard feelings. Then Nina's a new person who shows up, and they're both interested in her. And she's cautious but interested in both of them, and so it's kind of this fluid changing situation between the three of them.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah. I didn't even know that was a component of the play.
Yeah, I forgot to mention it, but there you go.
So what was it like writing that part of the play?
That was interesting. That was the kind of the biggest challenge, because what I found in the research that Susan Stryker had done was that she was really great at, and it seemed like her interest was in sociological and anthropological things, just giving a reader an idea of what the situation was. But in her interview, she didn't really delve into like individual psychology or interpersonal conflicts that might have existed among the queens that she was talking to. So that was what I had to kind of provide. Mm-hmm. And I think it worked out well, especially as we go through it line by line, like Ethan said. I'm like, oh, yeah, this does. There's drama that's moving along here and that's drawing people in, hopefully.
Are there any male hustlers in your play?
Yeah, there's one. There was someone who was involved in Vanguard, which is the queer rights group that sprung out of Glide Memorial Church. Who became the leader of that group. His name is Jerry, but then later he changed his name to Jean-Paul after Jean-Paul Marat from the French Revolution.
Oh, great. Wow.
Yeah.
So part of a big part of the play then is about the kind of emotional interconnectedness and other kinds of interconnectedness of the three main characters.
Yeah. I think that's what hopefully will draw people in.
And that seems very reasonable to assume. I mean, is that just the playwright's imagination, or were you also, in your research, were you finding this kind of interrelatedness between the characters, or was that something that wasn't really asked of them in Susan Stryker's oral histories?
Yeah, it wasn't really asked. People would make like stray references to the women having relationships, but that was never delved into.
Wow, I think that's something probably... Do you think that part of the reason you asked that is because as a trans woman playwright, that's something that you would fundamentally ask about the characters?
Oh, yeah, probably. I'm I always like to hear about the messy stuff, so I think so.
So is this a comedy or a drama?
It's a drama, I would say. Yeah. Or, well, what do you think?
I mean, there's definitely some moments of humor, yeah. But for sure, mostly drama.
Great. Well, it just sounds absolutely fascinating. I think we're just about out of time, so I guess we'll just wrap it up here. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to make sure to talk about either the play, the characters, or anything else?
I'm just very happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I would say, like, I'm a board member at Fuse, so I should be a loyal board member and say, if you do want to see trans art, please check out Fuse Theater Ensemble. We have a website. We always have stuff going at the theater. We have a lot of late night programming also. And it's, yeah, the pay what you will is an across the board policy. So please come check us out. If you can support us, please do. But there's a lot of trans drama and comedy happening at Fuse.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today on Transpositive, Mickey Gillette and Ethan Feeder. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Emma.
Thank you.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programs